You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for the Deep Dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a Deep Dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin. And this week's deep dive is on the 2018 midterm elections. And the reason why we're doing this is because, well, they're right around the corner. And basically, given all the issues and problems, and you guys can't have not seen that listening to this show or even just watching the news on the 2016 election and all the problems with technical interference and possible hacking and influence and all of that, it's a serious problem that I think we need to talk about. Now, if we're going to listen to individuals like the former head of cybersecurity for Facebook, Alex Stamos, he basically says, we're already screwed. Like, we're done. Like, it's too late for us to change this. We're so close to the election. And Mr. Stamos says, and I quote, "In some ways, the United States has broadcast to the world that it doesn't take these issues seriously and that any perpetrators of information warfare against the West will get, at most, a slap on the wrist." Now, that is essentially his belief in the state of our information and cyber warfare campaigns in terms of defending the election. Now, before we dive into the 2018 election and some of the things that we've already seen, we need to rewind ourselves back to the 2016 election, where we saw quite a bit of malfeasance. Now, at its most base level, if we're looking at confirmation for Russian interference in terms of did the Russians break into the DNC, the DCCC, think tanks, colleges, universities, looking for damning and sensitive information, emails, pictures, whatever they could find, to then expose that strategically to help sway the electorate one way or the other, the answer is absolutely yes. Aside from our major intelligence organizations within the United States that pretty much have a history of being fairly bipartisan, or nonpartisan would probably be a better way to put it, we do have third-party confirmations of this. The first one being a company called CrowdStrike. Now, CrowdStrike is one of the major players in cybersecurity in the United States. They've got excellent tools and utilities. They have actually a very good reputation. It would be their reputation on the line that if they were to lie about this, it would be a serious blow to their credibility. So they have no reason to. They basically were hired by the DCCC and the DNC and were able to put in monitoring tools and witness the Russians doing this live. And so they wrote a long technical article about it on the heels of the 2016 election about what they saw and everything and all of that. And that was a serious problem. So we do know that they did that. We do know that, you know, the Russians were able to successfully penetrate individuals like former secretary under President Obama, John Podesta. They were able to get his email and dump that onto WikiLeaks, for everybody to say. Now, on top of this, we can rewind even further from 2016 and go to 2014. And now we are talking about the Dutch intelligence service, the AIVD. Now, the AIVD actually started tracking one of the two Russian hacking groups. There's Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, as they're designated within the United States. They had been tracking Cozy Bear since 2014, breaking into various organizations, government entities, etc., both here in the United States and also in Western Europe. But the Dutch AIVD was actually able to witness in real time the initial penetrations and break-ins to the DCCC, DNC, et cetera, and we now have that. That has come out well after the 2016 election. On top of all of this, on top of the actual direct penetration and hacking, we know that the Russians set up an information warfare campaign to try to sway the electorate to move the needle towards one candidate or another by the use of targeted ads, by the use of disinformation, fake news, all of that, like actual legitimate fake news. And so they developed an organization called the Internet Research Agency, which was tasked with doing just this. They spent a few $100,000 in very strategic locations among states that could swing one way or the other. and then send targeted ads. They sent about 3,500 ads in about a year and a half or so. And you can go download and look at these ads. They have been compiled and put out by the US government. And so I downloaded them. I looked at all of them and it's really fascinating. We have some areas being targeted, with one very liberal and another very conservative message, looking at two different demographics in a specific region in an attempt to drive a wedge towards them. So, perfect example, one of the ads that I saw basically said, we can't trust the police, the cops beat us, they beat minorities, their stormtroopers are awful, all of this. And another ad in the same demographic at the same time, at the same geographical location, but a different demographic, would say, well, we have to support our, boys in blue and very pro police. And this is what we see. And so if we are able to allow, due to the openness and the platforms of things like Facebook and Twitter and all of these that don't really have a good policing model to combat this, even though they're trying to step this up, we are going to continue to see problems like this. And we're seeing it now. And so if we are fast forwarding now to the 2018 election, we can talk about Microsoft. Now, Microsoft obviously is a major player in technology. They always have been since the personal computer came out. And their cybersecurity division actually alerted three different congressional campaigns in 2018 that the Russians were targeting them. The Russian hackers had put up fake websites that looked like Microsoft Office 365 logins, and then were sending phishing emails to campaign workers at these three congressional campaigns. Microsoft did not release the names of these campaigns, but they were trying to get the campaign workers to click on the links to open up this website, to go to these fake websites to try to log in, at which case the Russians would be able to steal usernames and passwords, get information, email, possibly insert viruses into the network so that they could keep looking at this. Even more than this, Senator Claire McCaskill's campaign for 2018 got hit as well in basically the same manner. Now, what's interesting about this is that we are starting to see response within the United States of not just organizations like local law enforcement. And recently, basically, they held cyber warfare games in Massachusetts in how local law enforcement would respond to a cyber attack against the 2018 election. And for the record, our election is confederated. I mean, in Massachusetts, they all might tap, electronic digital screens in some precincts, other precincts, you might draw a line with a marker. Some of us punch a hanging Chad. I mean, it's really confederated. But if they're able to sway the information or attack, let's say, things electronically, the police are now being trained on how to do that. And this is going on, nationwide. In the 2016 election, the first state that had their networks penetrated for voter information was actually the state of Illinois, which happens to be the state that I am sitting in right now talking to you. So this is kind of near and dear in that sense. But we're also seeing a rise in the organizations, the social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Apple, et cetera, coming to the forefront saying, we're going to try and combat this. And so they've held meetings. These companies have held meetings. Now, originally, they had held meetings with the Department of Homeland Security and other intelligence agencies within the United States. But they left those meetings late last year, early this year, feeling kind of dejected that they were not getting actual guidance or help from the U.S. government. So they're taking it upon themselves. Now, that said, a lot of people can sit there and point the finger at Facebook or Twitter or, pick your social media platform to say, well, they've got an agenda in terms of censorship, because we also have that on the forefront of the news. We have provocateurs like Alex Jones being banned from these platforms. And the last one that I remember him being banned for was PayPal, of all things. So he cannot accept money through there for a lot of the inflammatory things that he said. And I don't know if you're an Alex Jones fan or not. I personally do not watch Alex Jones. I do think he inflames things. I'm not a big fan, I'll be perfectly honest with you, but we can't sit here and say that these social media platforms aren't being proactive. But that gives the individuals like Alex Jones the ability to say, well, I'm being censored. This is a freedom of speech issue. And so one of the things that we're going to have to really deal with and grapple with in this election is the fact that you know, what is free speech? What is propaganda? What is real news? What is fake news? How are we validating? How are we verifying all of this stuff? It's a serious, serious problem that we are going to see. There are some things we can exclude automatically. So, for example, one of the claims basically by President Trump, for example, when he was then candidate Trump was, well, we don't know if it's the Russians. It could be some 400-pound fat guy in New Jersey, you know, that is actually doing this. And I can tell you absolutely that it's not. And I will give you the logic for why it is not. So if we are looking at what an intelligence agency is going to do, if it's the NSA in the USA, or if it's the FSB in Russia, or, you know, take your pick of all the other intelligence agencies, they have a lot of very distinct and unique hacking techniques that only they know. The general public, a general cybersecurity contractor, a 400-pound fat guy in New Jersey, unless he is part of the Russian intelligence, for example, is not going to know those advanced techniques. The only one that's going to know those advanced techniques is going to be the Russians and most likely groups like the NSA. This is usually very highly classified. Now, if the Russians are using a technique that, let's say, is discovered and publicly known, so let's say a hacking group steals the tool that the Russians had developed, or it becomes so widely known that everybody knows the Russians do this, the Russians are going to stop using that, and they're going to continue to change up their game using new techniques. And so if a 400-pound fat guy in New Jersey, just again using the example that our now president used, was actually using techniques that the Russian FSB would use, unless that guy was in the Russian FSB or being supplied by the Russian FSB, that 400-pound fat guy would be using tools that were 6 months old, 1 month old, a year old, 2 years old. And any intelligence agency that is looking at that individual using Russian techniques, and you can route your connection through a VPN through Eastern Europe, just like the Russians could, they're going to look at this and say, well, that's amateur hour. We know that technique. We saw that years ago. Everybody knows how to do that. So you might be able to fool, let's say, some cybersecurity contractors that are not up with the latest and greatest techniques as they get released or exposed to the public. They're going to discount that immediately. That's how we know it's not going to be that quote unquote 400-pound fat guy in New Jersey. So keep that in mind as you are keeping this stuff in mind. But what this ends up coming down to, I think, in the 2018 election is the fact that we need to make sure we're having good controls in our electoral process, that we are monitoring anything election wise that is plugged in. So if I'm punching a hanging chad and it's not connected to the internet, that's a lot harder to hack unless the Russians or whoever are going to stuff a ballot box. But if it's electronic, it needs to be safeguarded. There needs to be intrusion detection systems in front of it that are monitored and all of this. And we also have some election companies that make voting machines that really need to step up the game, and they've been taken to task on and on and on this year. I've spoken about that drastically. But finally, the last thing we really need to talk about in the 2018 election is fake news. And that's a big problem that we have, is that some people, and I've seen this, you know, on my own social media, somebody posts an article from The Onion. The Onion is obviously clearly satire, but sometimes they get it right and sometimes they fool the public. And people take that and say, oh my God, how could so-and-so say that or do that, when it's an absolutely ridiculous article. Now, if we're applying people that are running an information warfare campaign to this, they're not going to be coming from The Onion. They're going to be coming from what may seem like a legitimate news source, but are offering hyperbole or unsubstantiated validation, you know, of situations or processes or quotes or words or whatever it is. And people are going to share this. People are going to have a serious problem with this. We've seen similar things happen in Myanmar, for example, where a lot of disinformation has come out regarding their Muslim population. They have a minority Muslim population called the Rohingya, and basically Facebook is one of the most prolific things in Myanmar for people to share news and information. Well, some of their big leaders have posted inflammatory or outright incorrect things on this population, and it has been taken by gospel by a lot of the population. And that is the fear that we have here, that we are going to see a lot of disinformation come out on campaigns, on candidates, on one political party or another political party, and nobody is stopping to say, hey, wait a second, let's validate this link. Hey, wait a second, let's think about this critically. Does this really make sense? Did they really say that? And what we need to do in our own lives And I think this is just as important as securing the election is when we are reading sources about one candidate or the other. So if you are, let's say, on the liberal spectrum and you read something that is just, oh my God, on conservatives, or if you're on the conservative spectrum and you read something, oh my God, about liberals, check it. Make sure it's right. You know, validate that was actually said. Is it in context? If it was said, was it a joke? Did he actually mean it? I mean, these are things that we need to be focused on. These are critical thinking things that I think are taken for granted these days because we're quick to share. And a lot of times in social media, when it's a friend that we know and that we trust that's sharing it, we assume it's automatically safe when we don't have that luxury anymore because all of us are susceptible to being fooled, even the smartest among us. You know, I am pretty critical when I am looking at articles because I am naturally skeptical by virtue of my job. And even I have probably posted things where, you know, hindsight being 2020, saying I should have investigated that more. You know, so it's on all of us to really work together to make sure that we are keeping that up there, because it's not just the 2018 election we have to worry about. It's 2020 and 2022 and 2024. And I mean, every even year we've got an election and we are going to continue to see growing information warfare campaigns against us. So please make sure that you are keeping a critical eye, and please make sure that if your friends are posting things that are hyperbole, politely point it out as well. Like, hey, I don't think this is right. You know, where this person doesn't link any sources that are reputable. You know, does this really seem like somebody would say this publicly? And if they do, then that's a serious problem. That person maybe shouldn't be elected, or, you know, whatever the situation is. So keep that in mind, because we have to make sure that we're keeping each other safe and we're keeping each other secure. So this has been your midterm election deep dive, and I hope you guys all go vote, because at the end of the day, whoever you vote for, it's one of the most important things that we can do as American citizens. Thanks. You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now let's take some questions from the audience. And if you would like your question read on air, you can find me at Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP, as I know I've mentioned before. And also you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. And I am more than happy to give you a shout out and answer anything about cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology that is on your mind. So with that, let's begin. Phil from Pittsburgh wants to know, will AI love us or hate us in the future? and I think, Phil, this is a great question. And it's actually really good timing, because I've got an article coming out. It actually might have come out. I have not checked recently, but it's going to be on smirkanish.com. And this is for Michael Smirkanish of CNN and SiriusXM. And it's basically an article called "Can AI Cure Our Isms?" meaning racism, sexism, etc. And I think AI is going to love us or hate us depending on how we apply the technology. Now, I'm taking that to mean, is AI pretty much going to, you know, is going to be a threat to humanity in the future, a la Terminator, right? Are the machines going to turn on us? And we do have a lot of government contractors working on things like AI for drones to make them autonomous, or AI for sentry weaponry that, you know, will basically, you know, guard a sentry 24/7 without needing human eyeballs, and will be able to detect movement and shoot at it. This is already being deployed in South Korea along the demilitarized zone with North Korea, and has been, you know, for a while. So we're seeing weaponry that could be, you know, turned into a Terminator or Matrix style hellscape, you know, if it ever decides to go up against us. But we have other AI that is being used and applied for very positive ways. Now, one of the things that I mentioned in my article is a robot called Now. Now, Now, N-A-O, has a basic artificial intelligence installed into it, and it is being used by organizations and think tanks to help autistic children cope with feelings, learn how to emote. And one of the things I wrote about in the article is, if we are able to use robots like Now to start teaching empathy, start teaching sympathy to put, you know, somebody else in somebody else's shoes, which is one of the problems that we see consistently with things like extremists, like neo-Nazis, for example. They lack consistently an amount of empathy. They can't empathize with, let's say, the victim that they are going after, whoever that is. So if we can use AI and robots to do stuff like that, we can possibly change this. And so one of the interesting studies that was done by, I want to say it was Northwestern University, it's in my article, that now basically there were 89 subjects of this, and they were taught to interact with Now. So you sit down in front of Now, the little robot, and you play with Now, and you do this and you do that. And the researchers eventually at the end of the session would say, okay, it's time to just flip the switch and turn off Now. Now, of these 89 participants in the study, 43 of the participants heard Now begging and pleading for its life. Oh, please don't shut me off. I'm afraid of the dark. I don't want to die. What happens if I don't turn on again? And of these 43, 13 individuals straight up refused to turn the robot off. They felt that much empathy and compassion that they said, no, I cannot emotionally bring myself to flip a switch that's going to kill this little guy. He's genuinely afraid. And on average, the other 30 people did flip the switch, but it took them twice as long or more to turn Now off. And so what that shows us, I think, is that one, we are developing artificial intelligence with emotional capability. And while it may not necessarily be human emotion to the nth extent, I think it's one of those things that makes it very rudimentary, as a learning tool to be effective, maybe to make the world a much more understanding and empathetic place if we apply the technology correctly. And we have other AIs that are going to be innocuous, those that, you know, let's say are looking through big data to find patterns in data that may help us hone our marketing or our advertising, or, you know, to gather evidence for a crime in a way that we never did before. These are all benefits. But when we're looking at the edges of what technology can be, good or bad, which is how I'm taking your question, Phil, we're looking at things like, you know, autonomous weaponry that will shoot, you know, indiscriminately, or we're looking at things like Now that are going to help us build an emotional lexicon that's going to allow the world to be a much more harmonious place, hopefully. So, Phil, that is my answer, and that's a great question, and like I said, just great timing, because I literally just wrote on this, and I hope you go check out my article on smirconish.com, and thanks for the question. It was a good one. And Sarah from Portland, Oregon wants to know, I use Google Drive to back up all of my files and stuff. Is this okay? Is it safe? Am I okay to do this? Well, Sarah, thank you very much for the question. Short answer is, you're probably using Google Drive, which means that if you are storing all of your data on there and you have like a laptop or a cell phone, and let's say that laptop dies or that cell phone dies and you cannot turn it on, all of your data is now safe in the cloud. So in that sense, what you're doing is you're adding a sense of redundancy to your life, because you know that anything that you are doing is in the cloud. So if you lose a device, or the device is destroyed, or the device just simply dies, you're not going to lose any of your data. So I do recommend using the cloud in that sense. And so if I'm talking to a corporate client, I'm saying we need backups on site, but we also need backups in the cloud, because if the site goes up in smoke or a hacker hits the local backups, now we fall back to the cloud. It's no different for a consumer as well. So if I'm looking at this, I'm thinking to myself, yes, you can absolutely do that. Now, there's a lot of options that you can use for this. I mean, there's Google, there's Apple, Amazon's even got one, and on and on and on. But here's the consideration that we have to have. We know that in terms of privacy and data mining, while you're storing things in Google and Google is letting you do this for quote unquote free, they are data mining you. And so if you have documents up there, they can scan the documents and read what you are typing or learn more about you. If you are storing pictures in Google, they're going to know more about you. They're probably going to scan this. You're going to be put into a facial recognition database. Let's say you are we'll use an easy term. Let's say you are in a lot of your pictures holding a can of Coke, like Coca-Cola. Okay. They're going to know by facial recognition in their AI that, oh, apparently Sarah really likes Coca-Cola. And guess what? You're going to get Coca-Cola advertising. Or maybe you are, you know, a writer and you write about cars all the time. Well, guess what? You're probably going to get advertising for cars. And so when we are picking providers to use for cloud services, Google and Apple and all of those look very attractive because let's say you have an Android phone and you're in Google, boom, instant access, very easy to use. A third-party provider that might be more secure, that might have better security standards and encryption, that won't data mine you when you put your data in there, might be a little harder to use. But that's the trade-off that you get. You're probably going to pay a little bit for that provider, but it's going to be more secure and it's going to be more private. Or you can go the Google free route and you can add some security to Google, such as two-factor authentication. So, you know, a hacker like me can't go ahead and steal your username and password and then log in as Sarah from Portland and get your data because that second factor of authentication is going to kick in and protect you. But we also need to know, or you also need to know, that you are sacrificing your privacy for that. So while you're protecting, you know, the world from malicious hackers, you are not protecting yourself from Google employees, Google search engine, and all of that. That's an important consideration to make when we are dealing with these things. And we know from past, and I've mentioned it on this radio show before, that past Google employees have been caught actually going into the accounts. They have, their engineers have access to the back end, a select few, not the entire company, obviously, but there was a famous case of a 27-year-old Google engineer just walking right into a 15-year-old girl's Gmail account and, you know, uploading her picture, uploading pictures to it, downloading it, reading her emails, et cetera, basically stalking her. And he was obviously fired, arrested, and I believe convicted of that. You know, but it's important to understand that you have that vulnerability right now. And if you're fine with that, if you don't care, if like, oh, well, they already know everything about me, so I'll just keep putting all my pictures and videos and documents and everything there, then so be it. You know, that's fine. But if you are concerned about both security and privacy, then I would highly recommend looking into one that is a private organization that is not connected to those things. They will encrypt the data in the cloud as well so that even their employees can't get access to it. But then obviously don't lose that password because nobody can help you recover from that. That's what I use. And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show. And I think we covered a lot of really good stuff. And I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time. And I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. And if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A ESP. Again, that's Nick A ESP. And you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show. And as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.